without further ado, the floor is yours. You're very warmly welcome.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for coming. It's a great pleasure for me to be here in Jyväskylä with you. And I have to say a thank you to Sirpa and to Reklas and to the Academy of Finland for financing the visit, and to Sari for a lot of help and support along the way. So, I arrived in Finland on Sunday night about the same time as the ice hockey result. And I have to say I was surprised, because I think of the Finns as being quiet, introspective people who like to go for a nice long walk in the country and that sort of thing. And then I picked up this book, yeah, and I discovered that the first of Finnish nightmares is to have people like me feeding back stereotypes to you about Finland. So I thought maybe I'd better stop and just start my talk. So it's a learning experience for me. It's lovely to be back in Jyväskylä. This is my second visit, I think. So, the T-Lang project. This is just a little bit of detail about the T-Lang project, which, as Sirpa says, is quite a big project. It lasted for 4 years, and Angela Kreese was the leader of it, and a number of us were involved in it. Looking at language practices in public and private settings in 4 cities in the UK. How do people communicate multilingually across diverse languages and cultures? And about communication and occurrence and failure with different histories and languages being brought into contact. As I will try and explain, the project kind of expanded, and our thinking about many things became very different by the time we'd finished the project, which is always a good sign. So we did detailed linguistic ethnographic investigations in 4 cities in England and Wales, looking at business and entrepreneurship, heritage, libraries, museums, sport and legal advice. For each of these themes in each city, we had a key correspondent, a key informant who we sort of tracked and looked at their multilingual and other interactions in their daily work and home life. So this was the area that we focused on in Leeds, that Sari knows, Hare Hills, yeah. Another view of it. So the industrial north, or the post-industrial north of England. So a very important theme, in a way more important than actually translanguaging, is the notion of repertoire. So I want to introduce that first. And I want to talk about the deployment of repertoire as being like a selection from the available communicative options at any given time. So I've got this idea of stop. So how can we express stop? We can say stop. And from my friends in the local cafe, I now know you can say seis. Is this right? Seis. So with a combination of seis and this gesture means stop. Think of the other ways we can communicate stop. We can communicate it semiotically with a visual green, amber, red. Red for stop, yeah? So we often find stop in any sort of signage which is to do with stop. Red is important, yeah? So we have a kind of an array of possible ways of communicating stop. Now, what about you want to come in the door. Sari wants to come in the door. So I can say stop, Sari, or I can indicate that, or I can combine it. What about if I just kind of literally blocked the door? My question for you now, we don't need to answer it now, but later I hope I will answer it, is if I block you, is that a semiotic action? Or is it a mix of semiotic and physical, or is it just physical? So can we include blocking in the repertoire of things that we can do to stop things happening? And I'll try and show you later on that I think we can. And in fact, if you think of sport think of soccer or indeed ice hockey, blocking and tackling are important. If you think of the semiotic repertoire of the ice hockey player, presumably being able to block another player is important. Is that right? So something like that. So in specialized kind of areas, we can see this already. No, in fact, it wouldn't really do, would it? It wouldn't work. So I could go on about stop, but this paper is not really about stop. two metaphors for theory. I think there may be more, and if anyone's got any more, let's hear them afterwards. I think of theory as being a tool for thinking with. So the theory enables you to see things, or to think thoughts which are not available to you without that theory. So it's a kind of one, that's one dimension of theory. And the other is as a way of seeing. And Charles Goodwin's paper, Professional Vision, is all about that. If we become teachers, we see classrooms differently than we would if we hadn't had any formation as teachers or archaeologists or geologists or whatever. So theory is a tool for thinking with, and that's what I'll be drawing on, I think, more today, because I'm going to sort of compare and contrast translanguaging and code switching, which is an obvious issue and question. Why do we have translanguaging when we've got this perfectly good notion of code switching? But more of that later. So the translanguaging turn, I would argue, takes us from system and structure of the language to practice, language as practice. It takes us to consider the idea of disinventing language. There's a focus on repertoire, which I've mentioned already. There's an emphasis on translanguaging as language from below, and I'll discuss this in a moment. And translanguaging is potentially regulated by normative language ideologies, and I'm thinking particularly of monolingualism and separate bilingualism. Yeah. So the way that translanguaging is sometimes, and it's a criticism I think I have of a lot of the literature, it's seen as this kind of free space for communication and sharing. But actually, there's quite a lot that can militate against it. So that's really one of my sort of points. These ideologies are very interesting. We often think of them on the national or the local or the institutional level. But I think we can sort of experience these internally as well. And I'll give you an example. I can speak to degrees of fluency, so a number of languages, particularly French and Spanish. Now, I've always had the feeling, a kind of a pride, if you like, that I don't resort to English. When I'm trying to speak French, I do it all in French. But actually, I've started through doing this work on translanguaging and thinking, well, why am I so hard on myself? If I don't know a word in French, why don't I just say it in English? And I've started doing this, as many people do. So I think we can absorb these ideologies, and this separate bilingualism ideology is one of them. Anybody who works in classroom discourse knows the effect of, don't speak Swedish, don't speak Finnish, don't speak this, don't speak English, because you're here to learn something else, yeah? Here are some definitions of translanguaging. There's one from Kanigaraja, there's one from Liwei and Garcia, and there's three sort of preparatory ones from TK Tong Lee and I were preparing our book, about which more later. There's going to be, a break for advertisements, a short break for advertisements later on. These are the kind of ways people were thinking about have been thinking about translanguaging. So one of the important points about the TLang data, and that's why I said it went very much beyond the initial focus, which is on multilingualism, seemed to show that translanguaging as a phenomenon went well beyond the simple coexistence and deployment of different languages in the repertoire. There seemed to be more things in place. And that's what I'm going to try and explain. And it led us to a framework which has been around for a while. Well, sorry, let's talk first about repertoires. This is a definition of repertoires from Spotty and Blomart, Handbook of Sociolinguistics. People perform repertoires of identities through linguistic semiotic resources. Now, that's important, semiotic resources, not just linguistic, yeah? Acquired over the course of their life trajectories through membership or participation in various sociocultural spaces. And again, I've highlighted in red, in which their identities are measured against normative centers of practice. And that's what I mean by these, monolingual and separate bilingual ideologies. So this kind of definition resonates with this notion of translanguaging not being in a sort of free space. There are ideologies at work which are trying to regulate the way we communicate in lots of along lots of different dimensions. So, trying to make sense of the different ways in which translanguaging seem to come into our data, we hit upon the idea, this framework that Jacobson originated on in translation studies, and it's been quite influential in translation studies. It's still cited and used. So he has the idea of intralingual translation, that's all within a given language. So he describes that as the interpretation of verbal signs by means of other signs of the same language. So it's kind of within the language sort of space. The interlingual translation, which he calls translation proper, is an interpretation of verbal signs by means of some other language. So that's what we mean by translation, typically. And typically, it's the way people talk about translanguaging. Translanguaging is seen as something that happens between and across and around languages. And interestingly, Jacobson, although he's introducing this very interesting framework, calls that translation proper. That's the real translation. So maybe translanguaging across languages is the real translanguaging. I would argue, actually, that it's more that it's the most visible form of translanguaging, but there are lots of more subtle and less obvious forms that are very influential for us. The third one is, the intralingual is really the domain of register, and I would argue discourse. This is discrete languages. The intersemiotic is looking at moving across semiotic systems. And of course, I think Jacobson would probably find quite unrecognizable, if you like, the work that's been done on multimodality in these few decades, the last two or three decades. So there's a complete transformation of this third one and a great increase in the importance of it. Anyway, this is what he did with his framework. And this is the way we tried to transpose it into identifying different elements of translanguaging. So interlingual translanguaging, translanguaging proper between languages, intralingual translanguaging, translanguaging that involves selecting from different registers, different discourses, intersemiotic translanguaging, all of the area of multimodality, but also, and I'll try and explain quite what I mean in a bit, something not envisaged by Jacobson, the idea of interdiscursive translanguaging, and the idea that translanguaging has something to tell us about the language body interface, which I've sort of alluded to already. So this is what we took from Jacobson, and we then kind of expanded the framework. And I'll try in this presentation to explain what I mean by all of these and to give you examples from data. And then I'll conclude by saying why I think all of this is important. So, light dawns, you see. Now, everything you want to know about translanguaging and translation will be available from June the 20th. This is the commercial break. This book published by Routledge. And I have to beg your... beg your forgiveness. This is another light dawns moment. I can't come to Finland without talking about this. The EU elections in the UK, in case you were wondering what's going on, 40% of the voters voted against Brexit, 34% voted for Brexit, and yet it's being proclaimed as a huge victory for Brexit. So this is the strange world we live in. Yeah, so light is not really dawning in this case. But I just have to say this to you because I can't really get it out of my mind. But moving on, this is the definition which we came up with on translanguaging. So we talk about translanguaging as the creative selection and combination of communication modes, and we've given you the whole range, available in the speaker's repertoire. So we're talking verbal, visual, gestural, and embodied. That's what we have available to us for communication. Translanguaging practices are locally occasioned. they're influenced and shaped by context, but also by the affordances of particular communication modes or combinations of modes in context. So they're local. They're always local and contextually produced. Now, translanguaging practices, we say, are typically language from below. In other words, language that are not kind of necessarily sanctioned by the dominant ideology. So children, you know, say, as students in a class kind of speaking in a variety of languages, and the teacher, or if not the teacher, maybe the administration saying, no, you shouldn't be doing that. You should be focusing on, you've got to learn English, you've got to learn Swedish, you've got to learn Finnish, yeah? So they're liable to be seen as infringing purist monolingual or regulated bilingual language ideologies. And from that point of view, can be understood as a kind of speaking back, either explicitly or implicitly, to these ideologies. So simply talking or using that variety of language has a sort of positive effect, or is a positive move in terms of saying, yeah, we don't have to, we don't have to follow your rules. We can do it our way. And we do. I don't really have time to talk in detail about that today, but there's actual sort of what I regard as empirical data showing not, this is often seen as an idea which we, as educators, you know, progressive educators might sort of advocate this approach. But actually one of the subjects who we interviewed as part of the, or we collected a sort of data as part of the TLang project, this fellow, he was a Czech fellow, and he wanted to get a letter to get his driving license from Czech Republic. And there was this kind of argument around how the letter should be framed. And the person who was translating it and writing it wanted it to be done in good Czech, because she thought that the Czech people reading it would value it less if it was in sort of non-standard Czech. And Mr. T, the person, he was saying, no, don't worry, they'll understand. You know, so he had what I would call a translanguaging ideology, which is, regardless of the actual form of communication, if it gets across, it works. You know, so there is a translanguaging ideology, I would say, as well as these sort of normative purist ideologies. So that's kind of like an interesting area to develop. So I want to talk briefly about the idea of code switching as opposed to translanguaging, and to ask what kinds of thoughts about language and the social world are enabled or disabled by code switching and translanguaging. How do we understand the relationship between the two? And for that, I want to talk us through an example from Penny Cook and Otsuji's book on the language of a marketplace in Sydney. So here's the excerpt. Can everybody see this? Is that clear? Yeah. So this is Muhib and Talib, who are from Lebanon, are working on a vegetable stall, and they have a customer from Maltese background. So M says, how many boxes does he want? And Talib says, tamaner, sita, arba. Oh, four. So tamaner is sita, arba, is all Arabic. Oh, four. Yeah, no worries. Tell him arba washirin, tell him 24. I told him he wants to try to get it for cheaper. Arba washirin. And he opens a box of zucchini. Hurdle misfarin. Misfarin hurdle. They're yellowing. They're going yellow. Asfar. Asfar. So he is the client. He's the customer. And he understands asfar. So we understand asfar in Lebanese. Isfari, isfari. Yellow, yellow. Okay. So basically, there's this interaction going on in Arabic, and CM, who's the customer, from the Maltese customer, gets it. Now, there's a perfectly good reason why he gets it. Let's see what Penny Cook and Otsuji make of this. So Talib's use of Arabic to acknowledge the zucchini that are trying to sell have turned yellow is picked up by the customer. He knows the meaning of isfar. This seems to concern with Joseph Few, that they know a bit of each other's languages. Though in the case of Maltese, this is not wholly surprising. Isfar is also the Maltese for yellow. More generally, this shows how people draw on their own resources in achieving tasks at hand, and how items such as yellow zucchini play a mediating role in the metrolingual action. Metrolingual practices concern the whole package of linguistic resources, personal trajectories, and repertoires, objects, and spaces, which is wonderful, and it's very much a kind of an articulation of this kind of translanguaging, sort of metrolingual, multilingual practice. What it's missing is one thing, is that Maltese is in effect a dialect of Arabic. More than in effect, it is a dialect of Arabic. So by going for the practice, the situated practice, and ignoring the language structure, they're missing a very important element of the analysis, which is the relationship that is created between Maltese, that exists between Maltese and Lebanese Arabic, which is why, I mean, these are the Maltese numbers. And I'll say in Arabic, واحد اثنين ثلاثة أربعة خمسة ستة سبعة ثمانين and ألفين, that's 2,000. So they're totally similar. So anybody who speaks Maltese would be able to understand the number system of Arabic and lots of other basic vocabulary. So ignoring this kind of, if you like, the structural systemic nature of language, it sort of deprives you of a whole area of information about what's going on. So simply to treat, as I think that Pennicock and Atsuji do here, this is a lovely situation where people are sharing or exchanging with language. Actually, there's other stuff going on as well. So to me, this the analysis ought to combine an emic perspective. I don't imagine for a moment that the participants are here or saying, oh, we're sharing because we speak dialects of Arabic. But the fact remains that there is something there. So I think for an effective analysis, you need both an emic and an etic perspective. That is my argument here. So Maltese numbers. So here is some examples. I'll start with interlingual translanguaging because it is the most obvious, sort of most visible kind of translanguaging. And this is from an Italian friend. She posted a Facebook in Italian about her adult son having returned temporarily to the family home. Perché il suo appartamento è Airbnbato. So she's made this wonderful verb from Airbnb, Italian Airbnbare, to Airbnb your flat. Second example from really quite a long time ago. We had a visit from Paris from a family. The mother was English, the father French. Their toddler runs into the garden to watch a plane passing and rushes back into the house shouting, Maman, maman, l'avion il est gone. Yeah. So again, you have this kind of blending and bringing together of French, in this case, English. Again, many years ago, I brought my girlfriend, soon to be my wife, to meet my Moroccan friends. The grandmother who congratulated us wished us Jouge de Babyette, two babies. Yeah. So baby, she takes the word baby and she turns it into an Arabic word by adding the ending. Let's look at a few more examples. This is from a legal advice session on immigration as part of our data for the TLang project. There's Lucy, the lawyer, Musimwa, the advice seeker, and Valentina, his wife, who interprets. And Valentina is explaining what Lucy is going to do to Musimwa. Ako cheke avant asala pelwana. Yeah, so what's she doing here? Ako cheke. That's actually like a three-layered combination. You've got the English word check. You've got the French ending to check, cheke. And then you've got the prefix coming from Lingala. So this is a very creative combination and quite commonplace, creative and commonplace combination. Much, much more commonplace in French and Lingala. The fact that English is in there as well is because these people are wanting to settle in England, and so they're picking up lots of vocabulary, particularly related to the legal process of gaining asylum. Here's another example. So Bacco étudier. So this is a French one. They will study your case now, your case, yeah? Bien au signeté. Mais, so you can see the way French comes into Bacco étudier again, yeah? They will study your dossier. I consulted a Lingala specialist, Michael Mervis, on this, and we talked. He showed me some very interesting combinations, like bas papier, the French word papier with the prefix from Lingala, bas question, the same. Ako cheke, she will check. Lingala ban morphemes, ako plus check, the English verb plus. So if you look at the language analytically, there's some very, very interesting things going on. But that's not necessarily to say that the speakers are sitting there thinking, oh, well, I'm going to just put together a little bit of English, French and Lingala, yeah? Babouke. So these are some examples of the multilingual translanguaging. Quite a lot of the data we collected were involved in interpreting events around advice giving of different sorts. So if any of you are familiar with interpreting the dynamics, the typical structure, A doesn't share language with B, so communicates with B by means of C, who shares both B and C's languages. So it's a kind of triangle, yeah? So M is the advocate, K is the interpreter, N is the client. Do you intend to claim reduction of your council tax? So K translates into check, but you'll notice she doesn't translate council tax. I wonder why. Any idea why she wouldn't? Why would you not translate that into check? Possibly because council tax as a concept doesn't exist in Czech. So the vocabulary that has been learnt within the context of the British system comes through in English. And you see it again, housing, yeah? She says no. So this typical triadic structure, systematic shifting between languages in this mediated interpreting event, which we see as a distinctive kind type of interlingual translanguaging, and there were kind of lots of it, yeah? Okay, so moving on. So the interlingual translanguaging data we collected involves both English-Czech translanguaging and Czech-Slovak translanguaging. A number of the interactions involve English, spoken by the advocate and the interpreter, standard Czech, and relatively frequently a blend of Czech and Slovak spoken by the client. So it's quite a fluid and dynamic language situation. And the people who were involved in the project, in this part of the project, were very largely Roma, the clients. They're considered to speak an ethnically marked variety of Czech or Slovak, and the use of the Roma language itself is kind of kept in-group. It doesn't become visible within the kind of out-group interactions like talking to social workers or advice givers. You don't get it. It was very, very rarely you might hear a word or two. Okay. So interlingual translanguaging. I'm going to talk about register and what we call epistemic flattening, which is trying to reduce the social distance in a kind of say, for example, an advice-giving situation where you have a lawyer giving advice to a client, as we've already seen. What does the lawyer do in order to enable communication? It's something around shifting of register. And it's linked to the idea of cultural brokering, which is something which happens when knowledge is shared and negotiated in contact zones, where all participants are notionally speaking the same language, yet the differences within that sameness create boundaries to cross and obstacles to surmount. It typically involves issues of register and discourse, okay? So this is why we couldn't say, oh, let's just stick with multilingualism. That's what we set out to do. Register was completely kind of pushing into our analysis. We couldn't avoid it. And for example, here's an example. coming from the English, Czech, Slovak interlingual translanguaging, but yet register kind of comes into it here. Clara and the researcher discussing how to translate into Czech the English term sworn statement. We can also see this element of intralingual translation comes in that Clara's strategy seems to be to break the English legal term down into its simplest elements and then rebuild it into a term that would work in Czech. So you can see, I'm not going to try and read the Czech, but this term sworn statement. And then how would I translate that? I was thinking, like, you could take an oath, like an oath. I was thinking the oath of Mr. T. So you can see the kind of bricolage that's going on in which the two people, the researcher and the translator, the interpreter, are working on this term, sworn statement. And again, I won't go into this in detail, but we develop a sort of a way of thinking about translation, which is kind of looking at the actual bricolage, the moment-by-moment negotiation around meanings in which the translator or translators draw on their multilingual repertoire. So it's a kind of repertoire account of translation, which we develop in the book, but I'm not going to talk about in detail today. Here's another example. This is Lucy, who's a lawyer, talking to a client about her son, basically. The son, what you're looking to do for him, or what the only thing you could do at this stage is to try and reapply, to revoke that deportation order. So what I've done, I put in bold the technical terms, the legal terms connected with the whole asylum process. And then she switches from this kind of formal register, and then she says that's going to be difficult because he's been out of the country. So what she's doing, she's creating a kind of bridge, and this is what we mean by epistemic flattening. She has to use those terms because they are the legal terms. She can't avoid them. But so what she's doing, and she also doesn't speak another language. So the other examples we were looking at, they were able to use a common language to translate. Here, this is really looking at Lucy as a communicator who's using the way she can shift her English in such a way to communicate effectively with somebody who doesn't have easy access to the legal terms. So again, the grounds for revoking a deportation order, that is taken directly from the legislation, you know, or the guidelines, yeah? Are that something in the situation is now significantly different to warrant the Home Office opening that up. So that's very much a kind of statement of the kind of legal position, and it's using the legal language. So that's one element in the interlingual translanguaging. And then she glosses it. She says, so if nothing has changed, if he's still in the same situation and you are, it's not going to be successful. So she kind of switches, she shifts away from the formal language. So this is what, when we talk about the register dimension of translanguaging, it's shifting between technical to everyday registers is what's going on. So what do I mean by interdiscursive translanguaging? I had a kind of light bulb moment about this with some of the data. So again, all of these constructs came out of the data. It wasn't that we set up, we're going to develop a framework and then find it. It very much emerged empirically from the data. And I'll try and describe what it was. This was, you've got to imagine an advice centre for migrants, refugees, etc. And one of the procedures in the advice centre is everybody has to fill in a form, so they have to have a record of everybody who's come and received advice. And we have an equal opportunities monitoring system in England, and I suspect you probably have as well. Gender, race, equality. Yeah, is that something that you do here in Finland? Certainly is in Sweden, because I've given a similar...
Race.
Sorry? Okay, so what is there? I'm curious.
Quite often it's language.
Just language. So gender?
Gender
is important, but not race.
Race.
Okay.
It's important, but it's not...
It's not visibly. Okay. So this was basically, the manager of this project came in and he was filling in a form for somebody at the same time as he was having his consultation. And it started off with name, address, age, whatever. And very soon it got rather, I'm going to come back to that, having started talking about the example. So K, he's completing this registration form with T, who's the manager, which includes the equity question. And in the extract of the section, there is there's a question on sexual orientation. And K, who's the interpreter, she hesitates and says in Czech, "Jste heterosexual?" And T is, "What? Why are you asking me this?" He said, "What is it?" And then he says, "I like women." So he's basically completely not got the, hasn't got at all the idea about why he should be asked that question. And in a way, why should he? Because it's strange. If taken out of context, it's a very strange question. So there's this kind of embarrassed laughter going on through this, which carries on. I'll give you the whole extract and how it carries on. And S, who's the manager, already says, "Is it easy to ask this question?" So there's a climate of embarrassment. People are feeling embarrassed about this question. And then after the question about sexuality, it goes back to a safe subject, date of birth. And then, but K, the interpreter, why is it there if people feel uncomfortable asking it? So there's this atmosphere of discomfort is generated. S, "I feel uncomfortable," says the manager asking this question, "but it's kind of required." And do you notice this, "it's kind of required," this neutralizing sort of passive kind of language. We have to do it because they're not kind of owning it. So they carry on, 1968. And S, the manager, "sometimes people have funny reaction." And K explains then in Czech, they just have those questions there. Somebody asks. Sometimes they don't. It's for some statistics, perhaps. So can you see the way she's kind of distancing herself from the whole process? Now what I would argue, I'll go back to the slide going back. This interdiscursive translanguaging occurs when there's an unfamiliar discourse that needs to be negotiated. And it's similar to this notion of cultural brokering or mediation. And here it's the discourse of equal opportunity monitoring. So there's no actual problem. Mr. T completely understands the question, but he cannot understand why he's being asked it. Yeah? So the reason he's being asked it only makes sense within the frame of equal opportunities monitoring. And this is why it's not enough, I would argue, to talk about this kind of language work within the language simply in terms of register. It's not a question of register, it's a question of discourse. And if it's a question of discourse, then some people have certain discourses within their repertoire and some people don't. Yeah, that's really the argument. So some things are not explicable simply in terms of repertoire. That's the basic argument. Okay. So moving on, we're getting on to the visual verbal. So describe a spiral. You don't have to do it out loud, but imagine what would you do in order to describe your spiral? Exactly. And this is a little kid's game in England. We used to sort of do this. Ask somebody to describe a spiral. What do? They describe a spiral with their finger. There's literally no better way to do it in language. So this, if you like, is a sort of illustration of the affordances I mentioned earlier, that there are certain situations where the affordances of the communication point you to more towards a visual mode than for a verbal or to a combination of that. This is an example. You may not be able to see this very clearly. I'll try and talk you through it. This was something I saw at Barcelona Airport. And it's on the bridge joining the plane, and it's basically saying security, safety for connecting the bridge to the plane. And it says in Spanish, "Recuerda siempre dar el OK, always remember to give the OK sign, después de conectar la pasarela, and then you see a person in a yellow jacket, so clearly a worker, and in the plane there's somebody giving an OK sign, so they're communicating. So what we have here is a kind of a visual, a verbal, but also that there's verbal. I mean, you could argue that OK is so embedded in different languages, it's not even different language, but there's something there which is a little bit different, dar el OK. And so you have gesture. All of the elements that I've been talking about kind of come together in this example, which annoyingly in the book, they're only printing it in black and white, because you sort of lose it if it's in black and white, but never mind. So this was an element, this happened last year. I don't know if you saw this picture. Famous, you know, went around this fellow, as you can see, scaling up the walls, the front of an apartment block, to rescue this child who was dangling. You know, it's quite a very dramatic story. And it became, overnight, there's this wonderful Dutch-based cartoon. It's called Cartoon Nation, or some name like that. Anyway, this basically, good migrant, bad migrant. So we can see the semiotics of green and red. Yeah? Don't stop, don't go, don't, and green, you're free to go through. So a very, very complex image. You've got the verbal combining with the visual. You've got the iconic, the EU flag. You've got the tick and the cross, the colours. So it's like an image which has everything, all of the elements you might imagine in communication. And this is why I was really using it to bring in this idea that, and it's not a new one, but goodness knows, it's not a new one, that basically communication, it's very difficult to imagine communication if we're not imagining the interaction of verbal, gestural, and image. Yeah, it's a commonplace now. But also we need to think about it in terms of the notion of repertoire and how people bring these images together, not just in a kind of cartoon context, but in everyday life. So, how am I going for time? So, I'm nearly done, so I have to say goodbye to... Ah, convenient. See you, Tomas. So I want to come back to this idea that blocking somebody is a semiotic activity. And in fact, this is something... there's absolutely nothing new in the world. I think you'll find that somebody's always sort of thought about this. And we were sort of working on this idea about embodied performativity, and then Judith Butler came up with this wonderful statement of it, based on, she did a book on street protest during the Arab Spring, which some of you may have come across. And what she's arguing is that the bodies in the street, literally by coming into the street en masse, you're speaking. It's a kind of speaking back to power. So she says, when the body speaks politically, it's not only in vocal or written language. The persistence of the body calls that legitimacy into question, and does so precisely through a performativity of the body that crosses language without ever quite reducing to language. So that, to me, kind of answers that my question about, is stopping someone with your body a performative act? Well, yes, it is. It's not exclusively a performative act. There is a physical dimension, a dimension of physical presence. But to me, that's the kind of the argument which supports this idea that embodied communication needs to be seen as part of the repertoire of what we have available to us in our everyday communication. So I'll give you some examples of this. This was a young woman Alicia, I think she was confronting armed sort of troopers. What's she doing? She's standing there, and you can see the kind of the conflict, yeah? But it's all done. A lot of the work on embodiment in language is done about gesture, because gesture kind of accompanies talk. I don't think you can talk about that as a gesture. It's literally putting your body in a space. It's something more, and that's what kind of that's why I think it's important to emphasize. Gesture is the overlay or the accompaniment of language, but this is something different. And what I'm trying to argue, if you like, or what we're trying to argue, is that you need to see embodied action as part of the repertoire, the options available to people. And I'll give you some more examples. This is from the, this business, the American players who refuse to stand up. Here's this guy standing up, hand on heart for the national anthem, and these guys are not there kneeling, and they're kneeling as a protest against the Black Lives Matter, all of that, yeah? So there are amazing images, and I've got a couple more, one more anyway. So another sort of, they're basically really putting themselves on the line. And surprise, surprise, this did not go unnoticed by a certain person. So it provoked a sort of furious response from the president, from Trump on Twitter, denouncing players who kneel during the national anthem to protest against racial equality and brutality. And he retweets an image of a woman and a child on the ground near the grave of a soldier. Yeah, so it's a kind of argument that's going on through visual images, but also triggered by an embodied action. So again, it has this complex interaction of different modes going on. "So beautiful," wrote Trump on Twitter. "Show this picture to the NFL players who still kneel." So you can see this. I hate quoting him, but you know, sometimes you have to, that this interaction of the visual image with the commentary. And this again came a bit later, and this is an actual tweet. So "The NFL has decided it will not force players to stand for the playing of our national anthem. Total disrespect for our great country." And then we have the heart, the people who liked it, the logo for speech. So again, we can't get away from this sort of multimodal bringing together of visual, verbal, iconic, indexical sort of and performative elements. So hang on. Right. So what I'm going to try and do now is conclude this. I'm just going to read a couple of paragraphs from the book, which is why do I think all of this is important? And I'm going to talk also about translation as well as translanguaging. So the book starts with a conversation between me and TK, the other author. So I start, "I wonder if one of the myths which translation typically operates with is the notion of settled centres and translation at the borders. So we have this, it's like a sort of a suite with the centre in the middle, and then the difficulty all happens at the edge. If we imagine a space which is language A and a continuous space which is language B, then translation operates at the boundary, the border between the territory of language A and language B. This leaves the centre of language A and of language B somehow untouched, served by the transborder commerce between A and B, but otherwise inviolate. So communication across borders happens at the border. This is the myth of the language nation-state homology, so beloved of ideological purists. If you restrict the commerce between languages to the fringes, the border, then the monolingual heartland remains inviolate. Yeah? So what's really, really interesting for me about what I've been trying to argue, this take on translanguaging, the way we treat translanguaging, fleshing out and extending Jakobson's programmatic framework, unsettles this in quite a productive way. It tells us that difference isn't simply a characteristic of the borderlands, but that difference is threaded through the whole social fabric and incorporated into the repertoire. So we're constantly managing difference. I've spent the last hour or so trying to communicate to you the sort of thinking we've had. Hopefully it's worked, or at least partly, but we're constantly doing this. Yeah. Mary Louise Pratt memorably critiqued the centrality of the speech community in linguistics. And along with the speech community goes the idea of communication based on shared meanings and understandings. It's a kind of shibboleth of our fields. The idea of contact zones that she introduces suggests that communication typically occurs based on difference, that difference rather than shared meanings and understandings is the norm. So I think translanguaging, understood in this way, provides a way of understanding how communication based on difference, whether linguistic, multimodal, or embodied, is enabled in the repertoire. It thus makes translation, understood as the managing of difference, the central process of human communication, taking us beyond an oversimplified notion of the speech community, whose speakers all communicate using the same language. Difference works itself through in the most apparently homogeneous settings. And this enables us to say that all human communication is radically constituted in difference, and that translanguaging, this kind of detailed unpicking of the translanguaging, shows us how this unfolds in the repertoire. So this is what we're looking at, this kind of difference, which is threaded through all sorts of contexts and interactions. Okay, that's it.
Who are watching can hear you too.
Kiitos, Mike. There's a lot to digest, and I've been thinking about, especially the certain hostile settings and situations where there is no willingness to flatten anything whatsoever. I'm thinking about asylum hearings, for example. It's quite different from what Lucy has been doing in order to get people to understand and collaborate. And I'm thinking that how could we show through this type of analysis of translanguaging that when any type of translanguaging is not happening. So I wonder if this would be a powerful tool as well to show that when for example, any aims of epistemic flattening is not happening. Mm. Any comments on that?
Well, maybe other people have ideas as well, but my reaction is that there are sort of situations where language is weaponized, and an asylum hearing could well be a situation where language is weaponized. In other words, the intention of language is not to enable, but actually to reject and disappoint. I mean, there is the book, which I'm sure you know, Rejecting Refugees by Carol Boehmer and Amy Schumann. Yeah, so if the whole premise is rejection, then it's not a dialogue which is based on anything like epistemic flattening. It's just kind of how do you catch people out? And how do you say, you know, what's the word, kind of investigate the plausibility? And, they say something different one day. Oh, you said that last time you said this, and now you're saying this. That suggests you're not plausible. So the whole thing is a process of interrogating plausibility. So I think it would be more of a systemic change. I don't think it would happen through language as such. But if the change happened, then the language would shift. Yeah.
Thanks very much. I think it was very interesting. Something that I've been puzzled about for a long time is the notion of code switching and its relevance against the background of all the work that now focuses on translanguaging. Mm-hmm. And the thing that I'm wondering most particularly is that I don't see a lot of discussion of, you know, the ways in which code switching still might be relevant in terms of within the framework of translanguaging. Mm. For instance, I've been looking at, you know, linguistically heterogeneous and semiotically heterogeneous discourse for a long time. Mm. And what I've noticed in my data is that code switching, I mean, if you want to call it code switching, we could perhaps invent a new word to describe the whole phenomenon in a way. But code switching is still seems to be a fundamental means for meaning making in discourse, in the traditional sense that, you know, Gumbert's talked mm-hmm. about it. You know, it's a means for contextualizing your mm-hmm. discourse. Mm-hmm. And for instance, the example that you showed us about, was it the council tax example? I mean, you could easily argue, I guess, that it's an instance of code switching specifically because it, in a way, contextualizes the whole notion of, you know, what are we talking about here? Council tax. Mm. And it's something that's sort of anchored in the UK context.
Definitely.
And, you know, there is this implication of, okay, that this really makes sense in the context of UK. So it is a contextualization cue. Mm. And it could be argued to function as code switching. So what's your take on, you know, the issue of code switching versus translanguaging? That's what I'm asking.
Do you know what?
Sorry.
One of the things about my take that I realized as you were speaking, I sort of promised, in fact, one of the things we do in the book is actually have a discussion about the relationship. And I have a feeling that one of the, I thought I'd organized I did a paper in 1993 called Code Switching and Mode Switching, Community Interpreters and Mediators of Literacy. And basically I was arguing for code switching, mode switching and register switching, which corresponds with the basically my argument about code switching and translanguaging is that code switching sort of foregrounds the different languages or different varieties or different codes, and that translanguaging is the bringing together in the repertoire, so that to me they're perspectival.
Yeah.
And the argument, which I'm sorry to say I totally missed out because I was so busy putting together other things, I would see that it's a theoretical, what I would call a theoretical complementarity. Yeah. So it's really what I was saying with Peniko Konotsuji piece, they're looking at it completely, as it were, from the kind of translanguaging, language from below perspective, the repertoire. They could have looked at it another way, and that would have given them a different perspective. So that's what I mean by theoretical complementarity. And it basically, the affordance of code switching is it shows you this, and the affordance of translanguaging is it shows you that. And that's what I'm going to argue in Ghent. So this is my first opportunity, and I fluffed it because I didn't even mention it. But that is my argument.
I think it's a good argument.
Yeah. Well, anyway, thank you for reminding me. I should have said it.
Any other questions or comments?
Thank you so much. I have a lot of questions, but I'm trying to ask only two, or maybe it's just
welcome.
One
you
question.
You can make up because there are many spots.
So coming from more like the language learning side of things,
mm-hmm.
I'm very interested in translanguaging, but I also see a lot of sort of tensions between language learning and the idea of, you know, making use of your whole repertoire and so on, because language learning is like a very conscious expansion of your repertoire, and you have to kind of, on the way to expanding the repertoire, you're going to have to make some sacrifices. So in the way of, you know, sort of, it's a very nice idea that translanguaging opens up spaces for participation, and it enables people to communicate across differences. But then also from an individual's viewpoint, like, when is it that, you know, you get to to try out sort of, or to, you know, like, not make use maybe of the easier parts of your repertoire, those that are already there, but when do you get to expand it? So I think it's this whole question of participation, not just in this moment, but in, like, long term. So that is one thing that I'm thinking about and would be interested in hearing what you have to say. And I think connected to that, I'm very happy in the beginning that you mentioned this ideology, like, that language ideologies do play a role in translanguaging, because it is true that it's often people forget about this. But I was just wondering, so it's easy maybe to identify these kind of dominant norms, like monolingual ideologies and so on, but then later you said a translanguaging ideology that was displayed by someone. So I was wondering, what could that be, like a translanguaging ideology, or what sort of, what are, if language ideologies are not just the, you know, the dominant and normative and whatever, like, you know, what is an alternative ideology? Or I don't know. I don't know whether these two questions are connected, but those were the thoughts I had.
That's really interesting. There is a paper, I think it's either 2017 or 2018, and it's about this topic. It's analysing this particular episode when there was this letter writing, and the interpreter had what I would see as a standard language ideology. You know, in order to communicate with this bureau, you need to have a, you know, lovely standard Czech. And the guy was saying, well, why, they'll understand. So that's the language, the translanguaging ideology is, we don't need to do all of the kind of the niceties of language. They will understand if I just sort of put this, that, or the other. They'll get it. So now you might say, how can we call this an ideology? An ideology is not necessarily, I mean, the ideologies that we focus on are sort of dominant ideologies, but anybody can have an ideology, you know. I mean, so speaking back to a dominant ideology is simply to bring up another one, which may not be a particularly powerful one in that context. He was overruled. I mean, the person who writing the letter or putting it into Czech made sure it ended up in standard Czech, but he was kind of countering that. So you might say, well, what's the point of that? But I mean, there are language changes which happen through people who sort of, you know, the shift from Latin to vernacular languages in the Middle Ages presumably happened because people stopped wanting to communicate, or, you know, for various reasons stopped that. Going back to your question of learning, I think there are a number of ways in which having a very sort of strictly sort of regulated ideology around sort of, for example, monolingualism. You know, we can only speak English in the classroom. Might seem as a sort of a beneficial thing on the part of the teacher, because you're giving the opportunities of people to, and maybe if you didn't have that, they would be just not trying to extend themselves. So that's a practical argument. And the response I always give people in practical situations is, it make it a matter for negotiation. So rather than saying, it's all got to be English, it's all this or not that, say, okay, certain times in the classroom it's okay for you to try and work things out in your own language, but there are other occasions when you're going to try and do it in the language you're learning. So I think it's a matter of negotiation. The other thing is, all of the studies of, I mean, there was a study done in Tanzania by a fellow called Kazimiero Bagumio in, I think, the 80s, which showed that all of these classrooms, which were notionally English-only classrooms, were actually, if you looked at them, multilingual, or languages were coming in, were being used by the teacher, by the students. And even, I would say, in a class that is notionally monolingual, if you actually looked at what people were writing, if you look at what people are writing, you'll find that they're making notes in a number of languages, possibly. So there's a kind of reality around multilingualism, which I think has to be negotiated by the teacher. So I'm not saying for any reason at all there should be a, you know, just, or there should be no kind of regulation on the part of the teacher, because, I mean, you know, we live in a complex world. It's not, we just take away the regulation, everything works perfectly. But we need to acknowledge that, and it's not always a very effective way of going on. I've just written something. What's the name of the book, Sari, that we've been involved in?
It has to do with words, translanguaging and translation,
yeah,
and also arts-based research.
Yeah. But there's the particular paper by Camilo Bayena, and it's a paper based in Argentina, and it's looking at the use of indigenous... Veronica Unamuno.
Yes.
Virginia Unamuno. It's looking at the introduction of indigenous teachers into the teaching situation in Argentina, in a country that predominantly has the dominance of Spanish as the national language. But in the last few decades, there's been an acknowledgement of native languages, much as it might be with Sami here. I imagine there'd be a Sami issue in Finland and Sweden, etc. So what they're talking about is the introduction of the language, the indigenous language, into the classroom, into the curriculum. And they were negotiating with parents as well. What did the parents want? And what the parents want was for the children to learn Spanish, because that's where you get jobs. But they were also aware that jobs were opening up in the indigenous language because of the shift in policy. So they ended up having different spaces, and some of them were kind of translanguaging spaces. Some of them were indigenous language only spaces, and some of them are Spanish only spaces. So I think it's a matter of negotiation rather than saying it's either this or that. That would be my suggestion. So, but feel free to come on and carry on. So, yeah.
Thank you. I think because I wasn't really thinking about classrooms, but yeah, I was thinking about language learning in everyday life, in the outside. And there, the problem with negotiation is that people have very different positions to start with to even participate in that negotiation.
Well, I mean, the language learning in the everyday context. One of the things I think we see quite a lot of translanguaging is because people are not, you know, 100% fluent in any language, and they're drawing on a number of languages. It's partly an accommodation to use. You know, that's how people use language. They don't use languages in quite, you know, in a sort of discrete way. So how do people get challenged in everyday life? Lucy's very interesting, the lawyer, because she kind of has, one of her strategies is talking the client through what she's doing and making sure that they're aware of it. And she has a way of doing this without resorting to another language. She's doing it all in English, but by doing this shifting that I'm talking about. So that, I would see that as an important thing. And again, sorry to jump back into classrooms, because I have spent quite a lot of time, you know, researching classrooms. And we did a project in Sydney in the 90s looking at adult numeracy classrooms. And we concluded that one of the things that teachers do is to bring the students into the discourse. So talk aloud about what they're doing. Don't just do it, but say, okay, now we're going to do this, and I'm going to do this because that. So you're kind of sharing a sort of meta language with the students. And I think that's what Lucy was doing in her servicing, you know, her advice giving session. So I think that's the kind of thing you'd get people to talk other people through, rather than just doing it for them, talk them through it. And that could be a learning opportunity. So that type of thing.
Very, very useful.
So yeah, I just didn't quite get where you were coming from when you first mentioned that.
I would be interested in hearing what happens to the project. I mean, that translanguaging and translation project now that you're already producing output from that project. What's the next step?
The next step? Well, James has a next step, doesn't he? I'm sort of in a sort of semi-retired position, so I'm not about to get into another big project. But I think there's a move in Leeds, as well as here in terms of Sari's work, of looking at the kind of arts-led kind of creative practice as a way of engendering all sorts of things, including language learning. So, I mean, you were involved in that project, that proposal, weren't you?
I guess I am. it's a James's project will hopefully, it's now under review, but that will be about belonging, and we have a project on belonging and how belonging could be manifested or performed or narrated, not only through linguistic resources or repertoires, but drawing on everything that people have at their display, and this is also in the framework of migration and asylum, and how a sense of belonging is understood over there. I feel that all of the sites have different kind of trajectories how to go on. Some are more in the legal business. Some others are in heritage. Others are. It feels like that there are traces out of this in other areas, but also I feel that in Leeds it seemed to also develop more what would this work has to say in language learning settings or in language education settings. So this will come back to also. To more kind of a pedagogical perspectives, I guess.
So there was definitely, as the project unfolded, a focus on art-based practice, which has come through very strongly in the UK recently, as is, I understand, here. So I imagine, and this is not particularly me, as I say, because I'm sort of withdrawing a bit from the field in this respect, but... that'll be an area for development. One of the things I thought was quite distinctive about the Leeds focus of the research was a focus on economic precarity and the fact that almost everybody we were involved with were in precarious situations, not just the clients, but also the interpreting is a very precarious. I don't know if anybody's done it in the room. It's an economically precarious zero hours contract situation. So I found one of the things I think we were doing was kind of reminding the project that it's not just lovely situations where people are interacting and through language, there's also some quite harsh things that people are facing, and you mentioned at least one of them, which possibly was not the mood of the whole project, but it was something I thought was important to make clear. So we've continued to do that, and at least one of the interventions I'm going to do at I think at Stirling will be around that theme. So there's plenty to write coming out of it, plenty more to write. I don't see myself as particularly initiating new projects, but I'm very interested in the imagination of the younger people around who are doing so. So, yeah.
Thank you for reminding us about that. What usually seems to be on the surface that we are looking at easel or other types of contexts, actually hair heels or any other hair heels that we have around the globe is actually about poverty. Mm. So we're dealing with poverty and injustice, and these are actually, I think, arts based research is one way of looking at discourses and practices of poverty. So, so that is something that probably will be more amplified in future research that has to do with this. I think it is again. I think this. I'm really stuck now with this flattening, the whole idea of flattening. So looking forward to that.
Emily brought epistemic flattening into our kind of discussion.
And Jenny Louise van der Rij is talking about epistemic solidarity. So, and creating spaces for listening and being able to for people even to talk about these or through embodied actions to even perform what those topics that are under the surface, yet they be racialized or otherwise difficult topics. So I think this type of these aspects might be in future in kind of a more at play.
Absolutely. So, I mean, the other thing which I think I'd be engaging with is my sort of poetry practice. Sari and I have got a common interest in poetry, and is it the week, not this next week, the week after, there's an event on Thursday evening?
Wednesday.
Is it Wednesday? Well, anyway, you know, yeah. So I, that's probably some of these themes I'm sure will continue to make an impact on that part of my work. So, yeah. All right, well, thank you.
Thank you very much again. That was fascinating. And we'll hear more from you and your colleagues next week.
Yes, that's on another theme. Yes. That's the queer asylum stories.
Indeed, so please do come back for that as well.
And that's on.
And then the poetry event on the 12th.
Yeah, that's Friday afternoon, isn't
that's
it? Friday?
Afternoon.
12 till, yeah.
Thanks again.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me. I appreciate it. Yeah, okay.